Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's hard to believe, but 7 years ago this month, we were talking about Hurricane Katrina and how New Orleans was devastated and how the government couldn't respond. And we were talking about issues of race and rebuilding, and we're still talking about it. It was a major story. It affected so many people's lives. And our guest this hour went to New Orleans 5 months after Hurricane Katrina and kept going to New Orleans many, many times, regular visits over half a decade to document the struggle of the people in New Orleans to return to the area and to survive. And he chronicles these efforts with some very, very interesting people. You find interesting people in New Orleans, and Daniel Wolf chronicles these stories. In his new book, The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back, Daniel is a very prolific writer. He is the author of How Lincoln Learned to Read, 12 Great Americans and the Educations That Made Them, Born to Run, The Unseen Photos, 4th of July, Asbury Park, A History of the Promised Land, Negro League Baseball, The Memphis Blues Again, and You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke. I'd like to talk to him about that book at some time. Sam Cooke was great. So we're talking about this, and also he produced a documentary, which you will see, you'll be seeing soon, a documentary about the storm, and that will be, I believe, on public television coming up in just a couple months. Our guest is the author of The Fight for Home, Daniel Wolf. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486. I'm sorry, I gave the number. It's so rote that you do this number. Our phone, I didn't expect us to not have phones. So, which is understandable, we have to have you use a different line because our phones aren't working for some reason today, and we'd like very much to hear from you. So here is the number just for now, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050, which we should say is a local Milwaukee number. I'm sorry, the other number will not work. It's just in my head so much. I've done it for years that don't use that number, use this other number. Daniel Wolf, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on. This feels very familiar to be on online with someone whose phone doesn't work. That's what New Orleans was like for years.
Yeah. Oh, for years. Not just for right after the storm. For years, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, it took a while, especially depending upon where you lived.
Right.
Yeah. One of the frustrating things for the people we mostly talked to was that, you know, they could see on TV that the French Quarter in the tourist section of New Orleans, the phones and everything else were working fine pretty quickly. And where they were living, there was very little progress.
Right. Let's talk about you, and let's go 7 years ago. It's hard to believe it was 7 years ago now. When you saw this news, what prompted you? Did you have a book in mind? Did you want to just go down and help? Was it such a compelling story that you couldn't stay wherever you normally live? But why did you go down there? And then the second part of the question is why you kept going back and kept going back.
Well, my friend and neighbor is a film director called Jonathan Demme, and he and I decided we had to go down and at least look at New Orleans and maybe document it. And we had done some film work before together, and the original idea was simply to do a film. So we got down there and rented a car and headed, knowing nothing and no one, headed sort of into New Orleans and would stop and see what looked like awful devastation to us. And the people would tell us their story and then say, yeah, but you haven't seen anything yet. Keep driving that way. And we'd keep driving that way and eventually got to a bunch of centers of destruction and started talking to people there. Jonathan filming, me taking notes. And we thought what we'd do was last a visit or two and have a little something that could go up on YouTube. But the stories were so compelling and the people were so great that we kept coming back, and we kept back, came back about every 3 months to talk to folks. After a year, we made a series of half-hour shows for Tavis Smiley on PBS about folks down there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we kind of put those together into a movie called New Home Movies in the Lower Ninth Ward. And we followed that up with a movie called I'm Carolyn Parker, which is going to be on PBS in September 20th, I think it goes on. And that's a profile of one of these people. And we have at least three other movies in mind.
Oh, my.
In a project we call Right to Return. So in the middle of all this, Jonathan said, well, you ought to write a book about this, too. And, I had sort of been thinking about that, but I had been a producer, which, as far as I can tell, means you drive the car. So I kind of switched hats a little and started going back over my notes and looking at the interviews we'd shot and stuff and thought, you know, books can do some stuff that movies can't, and maybe this is worthwhile, and have spent the last couple years finishing up The Fight for Home.
You write about so many very extraordinary people, Daniel, and as you say early on in the book, the rescue operation wasn't supposed to be run by a bunch of ex-addicts and volunteers, but they are running a rescue effort, aren't they? The most unlikely people who are working tirelessly, and you expect that there's going to be somebody else who's leading this effort, like FEMA.
Yeah. Part of my belief after I've thought about this a while, Kathleen, is that if a flood or another disaster hit Milwaukee, shall we say, or Detroit, or I don't know, Oakland, mm-hmm. you'd see a very similar situation to what you saw down there, which is that, first of all, the people with the least are hurt the most.
Yes.
Because they don't have the transportation to get out of town, they don't have the connections, they don't have any health care, and so on. And then, while the government will try to help and maybe can help, eventually it seems to me it falls back on the people who are in the midst of it. It's an odd thing because part of what fascinated me, because while we depend on government and think it's always there like a kind of insurance policy, I think in the back of our minds we also know that when it comes down to it, it's probably going to be up to us. When you got to dig out your house, when you got to find missing relatives and so on, it ends up falling on the individual. And to me, that is a fascinating story, larger than the flood and more prevalent than just New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's tell some of those stories, and let's start with the very remarkable story of Pastor Mel.
Mm-hmm. Pastor Mel is a born-again Christian, came from a good middle-class family, African-American, dropped out of college to make his fortune, and as he said, ran into crack cocaine instead, spent 3 years on the streets. When we met him, he was clean and had begun a mission to help ex-addicts get off the streets, homeless ex-addicts. So he had set up this thing in a kind of marginal neighborhood in New Orleans that was wrecked by the flood, but that, in his own words, kind of gave them new purpose. Because they stayed. When the mayor said, everyone's got to leave, Mel said, no, you men who want to, stay here with me and we'll help people. And they ended up rescuing, by his estimation, some 75 people.
Goodness.
And then he was faced with the situation everyone in New Orleans had, getting his own house back. In addition to getting his parents' house back, they were 75. And for most of the people who died in the flood were elderly. The people certainly were hit hardest were often the elderly and the poor. So he was trying to do that, and he was trying to keep his mission going. This is a long answer to your question, but I'll finish soon, which is that part of what happened also from the flood was there were so many homeless people that missions like Mel's were, overcome in a lot of ways. And his has grown exponentially. He's doing both men and women now. And it's become a kind of permanent part of the New Orleans landscape, a homelessness that, according to some experts, American cities hadn't seen before.
Yeah. He says, and you quote him, that they say this was a natural disaster, a natural disaster. This wasn't a natural disaster. This was a man-made disaster in that it wouldn't have been flooded if the levees were built properly.
Not only his feeling, but a lot of people's feelings. And in fact, the Army Corps of Engineer ended up confessing, I guess is the term, that in many places along the levees, they weren't sufficient. In addition, there was a major canal that your listeners may know of called Mr. Go, which was a canal to be a shortcut to let people in off the Gulf Coast to the Mississippi River. It ended up being a kind of funnel that sent the tidal surge into the lower Ninth Ward and other parts of New Orleans. So it was badly designed, badly built, and what you'd call a pre-existing condition that the storm that was Hurricane Katrina just overwhelmed.
Hmm. You tell me about how many times you went down there and hover over how long a period of time, and if you could just sort of do a when we went back this time, we saw this improvement or lack thereof. When we went the next time, we saw this. You went down for a long time, didn't you, Daniel?
Yeah. I mean, we came down 5 months later, Kathleen, and they sort of said we'd missed the story. The story was the flood and the government's lack of response. We thought there was this amazing story there, which is an American city trying to reinvent itself with all the problems that any American city would have. We ended up going down about every 3 months for 5 years and continue to go down from time to time as these film projects need finishing up. We try to get the latest on our subjects. What we saw, the most astonishing thing we saw for the first couple of years was how little progress there was. It made no sense to us, and it made no sense to the people we talked to. You know, I remember Pastor Mel's mom saying, you know, they say this is the greatest natural disaster since the San Francisco earthquake in 1906. And yet that city rebuilt fairly quickly. You know, what's wrong here? And I think it was a bunch of different factors, but what we saw was incredibly small improvements. So if we'd come down in 3 months, installments and suddenly see that someone actually had gotten a roof on their house, that was major. The inside might still be gutted. They still might have no electricity and water, but at least they had a roof. And part of the reason we came back and people were so generous in having us back was they said, you got to tell the story. Right. I think America's looking elsewhere now. They don't realize that we're not getting anywhere. And, you know, a lot of them were living in FEMA trailers, which were sort of 20 foot by 10 foot. A lot of them had been contaminated so that there were breathing problems for the people who lived in them. It was a stopgap, and the stopgap lasted years.
Can you talk more? Pastor Mel talks about being hopeful that something new can be invented in this city after this great disaster. But the other word that he's heard used is that they want to make New Orleans a boutique city. You've got entertainment, good food, gambling, and all of this, and you come and then you go back to your home. But what about the people who live there? Can you talk more about what designs were in place and what these green dot non-viable areas were all about?
I mean, again, I think this is going to be familiar to your listeners without any hurricane, which is to say that the powers that be in New Orleans and the politicians in the first blush of having to reinvent the city said, okay, what we should do is figure out which neighborhoods really aren't viable, and we'll green dot them. They put a little green dot on a map. He said, okay, those won't come back, and we'll turn them into green space, or we'll turn them into parks or something. And if you looked at that map, it was the poorest neighborhoods in the city. So essentially what would have resulted had that happened was that you'd have a city with middle class and up, you know, running the tourist industry that you and I and everyone knows, Bourbon Street and so on, but without the poor. And even the lower middle class, that was the sort of solution. And in Mel's terms, that was a boutique city. So when they thought about rebuilding, they thought, now how do we get young couples with money back in the middle of the city? How do we get restaurants? How do we get music venues? But they weren't very concerned with the people who had often been there for generations and generations who didn't have much money. They were kind of dispensable. And the fight for home, as Mel defined it, and other characters in this book, was they don't want us back. We're going to come back anyway, whatever it takes. Again, I think you see that. I know you see that in Baltimore and Detroit. I don't know Milwaukee as well, but I suspect there's some of that, that the top priority is a kind of boutique tourist service economy with less interest in other folks.
Mm-hmm. New Orleans now, 344,000 inhabitants, three-quarters of its pre-flood population. Who's no longer there?
Well, it's whiter. It's richer. It is younger in some ways. I mean, I think one of the good signs, one of the hopeful signs, is there are a bunch of people who came either as volunteers or just because they were curious and stayed. And so I think there is a generation of 20 to 30-year-olds who have come back and want to redo this city, and black and white. So that's hopeful. I think that one of the things to remember that I sort of discovered doing the book was that New Orleans' population had been in decline since 1960. This was a city that, you know, was in trouble. It didn't really have an industry. So when you say it's three-quarter the size it was down 200,000 from what it had been in 1960. The flood kind of pushed it further in a direction it was already going, I think.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, Daniel Wolfe. He's the author of The Flight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. Our phone number, it's a different one. I need to pay attention to it, too. I got to write it down so I remember the right number. 414-227-2050. Just for today, our phone's system is down, so this is a Milwaukee local number. So that implies that it may be difficult for some of you to call, but this is the number for you to get us on the air, 414-227-2050. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tim in Eau Claire is our first caller. Hi, Tim.
Hi. A song that's always meant a lot to me, because I was born in Louisiana, and my parents were doing what they referred to as long-term camping, which I'm sure you can imagine what that means, is Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come.
Yes, love that song.
And when I went down to New Orleans for about 6 months after Katrina hit, I mean, it was September through February, so right in the meat and potatoes of it all. From the time my plane landed to the time I landed back in Minneapolis, that song was stuck in my head the entire time I was down there.
Hmm. What did you do when you were there, Tim?
Everything and anything that I could do to help. I have a half-brother that lives down there that runs a solar panel installation company. So we were getting as many people power as possible, plus, you know, after we were done working for the day, we'd go and help people rebuild their houses if we could.
Have you been back since?
No, I have not. I'd love to go back, though.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, maybe you want to talk with Tim.
Tim, thank you for calling in. First of all, it seems like you've summed up my writing career completely, going from Sam Cooke to New Orleans. You know, I mean, I think part of what's great about that Sam Cooke song is this possibility of a better world and a better city. And that certainly is part of the spirit of New Orleans now, that feeling that, you know, maybe a change really will come. Maybe we don't have to rebuild the city exactly as it was, but something better. And I also just want to thank you for coming down and volunteering. I mean, if I sounded a little negative earlier about how the government didn't step in very effectively, volunteers really did, and it was extraordinary. And everybody I talked to was thankful for people like you, Tim, who came down. And most of the volunteers we talked to were thankful for the opportunity. They say it changed them. Talk about change going to come. It changed them, and it changed their perspective as much as it helped other people get back in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Thank you, Tim. Unless you had something else, go ahead.
One other thing that I don't think a lot of people realize from watching it on television, and maybe the guests could talk to this a little bit as well, the smell. And, you know, something that I ran across, at least in the area that I was in, was people had no power, so they would take the refrigerators and then shove them out by the curb, and they duct tape them shut or rope them shut or do whatever they could to keep them shut because the smell was horrendous.
Mm.
And on one particular day, I remember what my brother referred to as the day the duct tape failed.
Oh.
When all of these refrigerators that had been sitting there in the hot, you know, hot Louisiana sun, all of a sudden the duct tape fails and they popped open.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
you know, and that was
probably the worst smell I've ever smelled in my life.
That was a problem about, first of all, clearing trash, but I think the other thing that was going on was essentially the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico had come in on New Orleans. So there were dead fish, animals, mud, all of that on top of it. And it lasted for a long, long time. I mean, Kathleen, you asked earlier what we noted. One of the notes was after it felt like 6 months to a year, finally that smell didn't seem to be around. Although people who came back to New Orleans who'd been living in Houston or wherever would say, wait a second, what's the smell? So there was still, you know, there's still a lot of the city that needed cleaning out. And when people would go into a house that had been shut up because nobody could get into it for a year or 2 years or 3 years, there would be that smell again.
You could almost pass out just thinking about it.
Well.
Yeah. Daniel Wolf is our guest this hour. His book is The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. He also has been producing a documentary film, and that's going to be on public television. Where's the cover of the book? It says when on September 20th, I'm Carolyn Parker is the name of that. Daniel has done all kinds of very interesting work. He's the author of How Lincoln Learned to Read, 4th of July, Asbury Park, You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke. He also is a poetry writer, a couple volumes of poetry, and he is co-producer of the ongoing Right to Return documentary film project. More phone calls in a moment. What's our phone number? I'm so thrown by this. We have a different number just for today, 414-227-2050. If you'd like to join our conversation, 414-227-2050. You can also use talk at WPR.org or leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, our guest is Daniel Wolf. He's the author of The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. Julie in Barron County, our next caller. Hi, Julie.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead, Julie.
Yes, I was struck while your guest was speaking, similarities between New Orleans and St. Louis, Missouri. St. Louis, Missouri is my hometown. I moved up to Wisconsin in 2003. But here's where it's similar, and I'm wondering if St. Louis is going to learn from this, because it has similar population, similar racial demographics, poverty issues, a lot of very old architecture that... you know, and history, and they are, in terms of natural disaster risk, they are, of course, right by the Mississippi River, had a horrible flood in the early 90s, and they are also in the New Madrid fault zone for earthquake, and you've got a whole bunch of unreinforced brick masonry in that city. And I'm just hoping that FEMA and the people who run the city of St. Louis, my hometown, and I'm from the city, not out in the cushy suburbs, that... You know, I wonder if your guest is, you know, if this is even on his radar screen. I mean, just in terms of learning for the future, you know, what could be done differently? Because especially when he told me that whole story about the green dots on the map, I said, my gosh, I could see that happening. Mm. Stuff like that has happened there. It has a history of it. It's like with redlining and stuff back in the 60s. And I'm just wondering if he could talk about that in terms of what we learn. Who's learning from it? Because I don't want to see my hometown end up as a pile of rubble. And that's what's really touching me about all of this.
Daniel.
Thank you very much for the call. To answer your question, yes, absolutely it's on my radar. It's part of why I wrote the book. And I think the answer for all of us is to not wait for the natural disaster to happen and to not assume that FEMA will be prepared, but more importantly, to set up livable cities for everybody in them. New Orleans was extreme. One of the editorials I remember when the flood actually happened was they said, well, this has pulled back the veil on poverty, was the phrase. And hopefully that veil stays open so that we can look at a place like St. Louis and go, now, there are these great old buildings. There are these people who've lived here a long time and deserve all the benefits that the rest of us have. How do you set up a city so if, God forbid, a disaster happens, everyone at least is living a viable life to start with and has some opportunities and can come back and rebuild? Again, if there's no flood in New Orleans, the city goes downhill in a way that the flood just speeded up. If there's no flood or earthquake in St. Louis, I worry that it goes downhill in a similar fashion unless we can turn that around.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had this momentary awareness of poverty, did we ever? We looked at it, and we had commentators on television even who were decrying it. I don't see a lot of conversation about that now, Daniel.
No, I agree with you. I mean, if there's a bright side to a disaster, it is maybe that people take a look at that and go, wait a second, this isn't right the way folks are living. There's got to be a better way. Again, I think part of the excitement in New Orleans now, for some people, is they come back and they go, okay, this is almost a clean slate. There's obviously a lot of history in the city, but it's also a chance to start over. And one of the issues the book talks about a bunch is public housing, where in 1940, right after the Second World War, there was some of the best public housing in America built in New Orleans. And since then, that's deteriorated and not much more has been built. And after the flood, the question was, okay, now what do we do with this? It was sort of a natural urban renewal. Do you rebuild this better? Do you take it away altogether? And it's issues like that, I think, in cities across the country that will prove whether or not we're actually going to make a better city and a better country.
Right. We need to talk about some of the other people and organizations that have had this strong presence, and they're such interesting people and organizations. This Common Ground organization that you write a lot about in the book, founded by a New Orleanian ex-Black Panther who brought people from pretty fancy-dancy schools from all over the country to get involved in rebuilding.
Yeah, Malik. Malik was a Black Panther. He lived in one of these public housing projects as a Panther, whatever it was, 40 years, 50 years later. Here was this flood, and he saw an opportunity to organize the way he'd been organizing since, but the way he'd organized as a Panther. And I think kind of to his surprise, and thanks to a lot of people's hard work, it rang a bell in a lot of college-age kids who saw a chance to pitch in, who saw a chance to be part of the community again. Common Ground was a self-professed radical organization. It didn't want to rebuild New Orleans the way it was. It wanted a bright new beginning. And that attracted a lot of kids. I mean, they were housing between 600 and 700 kids a month.
Goodness.
Volunteers. They could provide them, when we saw them, at first they were in an old church that they were rebuilding as they were camping there. Then they were in an old church's school that they were rebuilding and camping in. So there were none of the amenities. It was extraordinary to see. And these kids were there, and some of them stayed, partly because Malik was an inspiration and the idea was an inspiration, but also just because they wanted to pitch in. They wanted to do something. In the lower Ninth Ward, which people may know of, that was one of the hardest hit areas, Common Ground was one of the few relief organizations at the beginning that was really doing anything. And they were often breaking the curfew and breaking the law to do it because, as well as the green dots, the authorities were saying this neighborhood is too dangerous for anyone to be in. And Common Ground said, if we don't move in there and help the residents move back, it will turn into green space, whatever that means. So they took a very radical stance. in a lot of ways, Kathleen, I think they were forerunners of the Occupy movement.
Oh, my. Interesting.
It not only had some of the same motives and some of the same goals in mind, but some of the people who kind of cut their teeth in New Orleans went on to help organize the Occupy movement.
Huh. So how effective were they? How were they able to allow other people to stay in New Orleans and live there?
I think they did an immense amount of good. They gutted buildings, they loaned tools, they set up kitchens so people could get some food. They organized protests, but mostly every day their volunteers were out cleaning up and getting people a start. Did they make a brave new world? No.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, they couldn't transform the government and the kind of basic structure of the city the way they hoped, but Common Ground is still down there, and it's still building homes and still right in the lower Ninth Ward helping to organize. So, I mean, in many ways, it's an inspirational story.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And when you talk about cleaning up, you describe that in the book. We're talking about really nasty cleaning up.
Indeed. You know, as Tim, an earlier caller, said, there was stuff that had been there too long in the sun in a lot of cases. And it was very tough. And often, and it comes up in this book, sort of grisly for your listeners, but true, you would find people who were dead, who had been there for 2 or 3 months, who were in their homes, especially the elderly, and part of Common Ground's fight in the Lower Ninth Ward was that the city had hired outside contractors to level the neighborhood, because almost all the houses were destroyed, and they said, well, wait a second, you know what, there are people in there, and you need at least, if this was, you know, one of the guys says, if this was Florida and there'd been a hurricane in a, you know, better off neighborhood, you'd make sure that everybody was accounted for. And that was part of their fight, which they in fact won. It ended up being a much more careful process that honored the people who had died there.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. Daniel Wolf, our guest. Here's our phone number. It's different. We have a weird phone thing going on today, so it's entirely different. Just for the day, I hope. The number for you to call in is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. We'll take more of your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The author of The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back, Daniel Wolf, is our guest this hour. Our phone number, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Josie in Sheboygan, hi.
Hi, good morning. You know, I watched all that tragedy on TV, and it was just horrendous. And like somebody else said, it was a man-made tragedy. But it was man-made a lot more years ago when they first built up the town, in my opinion, because isn't the whole city below sea level?
Thank you for calling. The answer to that is about half the city is below sea level. To me, that was an important point, which is that, it's a viable place to live, an awful lot of this city, especially if you've built levees and set it up in a way that worked. And levees aren't the main solution, I think, at the end of the day. Part of the problem here, as some of you listeners may know, is that the marsh system, the sort of natural barrier to this kind of tidal surge, has been destroyed in a lot of cases. They lose something extraordinary like, you know, I forget, 10 football fields a day. I'm making it up. But it's an enormous amount of land, of marshland, that gets lost every day because they're cutting canals through it, because they're developing it. And so part of the city is a viable place to live for sure and has been there an awful long time, but we need to be smart about how you environmentally protect it.
Thanks, Josie, for the call. Could I ask you, please, about schools? Because I've heard differing things about what's happened to public schools, how many charter schools who have been established. You write about the president's first visit to New Orleans after his election to the MLK school, which is a privatized school. What's going on with the school system?
Well, New Orleans is the first city in the nation to have the majority of its kids go to charter schools. And it's, to me, as I research the book and look at the city, it was another case of the flood giving an opportunity to essentially try out ideas that would have been harder to put in place if there'd been a viable school system. New Orleans and Louisiana's educational system was notoriously bad. The state was in the process of taking over the city's educational system before the flood hit. After it hit, every employee of the school system was fired, some 7,000, all the teachers, everyone, and they started over again. So what has happened here is a major experiment. You see the similar thing going on, pieces of it, in Philadelphia, Milwaukee, across the country, but New Orleans is an extreme case. I think the jury is still out, but, Kathleen, I could go on a long time about this.
Yes, I'm sure.
But part of the problem, I think, so far has been that the charter schools have, while they've served low-income kids, they haven't been great about serving any kids with disabilities. And so, as a result, the test scores often look better. And they look better, but there are an awful lot of kids. We ran into a mother who had taken a long time to come back because her kid was disabled, and there wasn't a school that was going to take him in New Orleans. It's, to me, it was another way of determining what the population would be, who could come back, who could make it back there because the schools help their kids, and who couldn't.
Right. Tim, our next caller. Hi, Tim.
Oh, hi. Actually, my husband was calling for me. My name is Laura, and I'm from Minneapolis, and we're on the road coming back from Michigan, and I really appreciate the conversation here. I read an article a couple of years ago, and I believe it was in the Atlantic Monthly, and they talked about New Orleans being either a really poorly run American city or a really well-run Caribbean city based on its history and who had actually settled there. And I thought that from an urban planning standpoint was really interesting. But the other thing they talked about was like the design of the so-called shotgun shacks and how they were designed so well for the climate there and really served the people well. But also that people would hand down property, their homes, from generation to generation. So even though wages were low, people needed very little to live, which left them a lot of time to create, to be part of communities, and to probably help make New Orleans as special as it is. And one of the big losses that they lamented was that these homes would no longer be in existence and that people would have to work very hard now to find new homes, and that in itself would really wipe out a lot of the cultural freedom and the economic, you know, hand up that allowed people to actually do all the wonderful things that made the city such a great place.
Wow, Laura. Thank you for the call. That, you know, that's about 18 important points that you bring up all at once. Let me try to address some of them. Carolyn Parker, who's the subject of the movie next month on PBS, and who is in this book as well, had a double shotgun in the Holy Cross neighborhood in the Lower Ninth. And she's African-American. She was a single mom. It was a house that she wasn't going to let go. She was simply going to stay there. Now, the double shotguns and shotguns in general are, you're right, this fascinating architectural sort of evidence of New Orleans' cultural identity. They started springing up after the Haitian Revolution, so we're back in 1804 or 5, when people fleeing the revolution came to New Orleans. So as well as the Spanish and the French, there was a big Haitian population that built a Caribbean kind of city. I think That's absolutely true. That history was also specifically having to do with slaves and with Native Americans, and that the architectural style of a shotgun, the historians think, came from West Africa and from the Arawak Indians. So it was known as an architecture of defiance, I found in one of these studies. It was like, we're going to build our houses differently. It's a source of pride. And generations and generations later, you could see it in Carolyn Parker. This is a home I love. I got to come back to it. I don't care what it takes. And she lived there for 6 months, washing in water from the fire hydrant, using batteries as her only electricity, because she was sure if she left her house, they'd tear it down. The other part of the question that I want to talk about, which I think is really key, is this business of culture and where it comes from. You know, New Orleans is known for its food and its music and its Mardi Gras Indians and its style, almost all of which have an enormous amount of debt they owe to the poorest people in the city. That's who created this culture in a lot of cases. When the city in rebuilding goes, here's who we want back and here's who we don't, and eliminate the poorest people in a lot of cases, they're eliminating the people who are the not only the makers of that tradition, but the holders of it, who remember how to do it, who can continue to keep the tradition alive. And I think in an ideal world, what you'd have is a society that supported people and, as Laura said, gave them the leisure and the time to create this culture. And hopefully that leisure and time wouldn't be because they were unemployed, but because they had decent enough jobs and decent enough homes and decent enough health care where they could say, okay, you know, I got a little time here. I could make some music, and you end up with Fats Domino.
Well, what you said is very important, don't you think? That's not something that's discussed very often. It's very important.
Yes, I do think it's important.
Yeah, it is. Very important.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, I started writing about rock and roll is how I got to the Sam Cooke book. And, you know, if you love rock and roll, if you love popular American music and most of its culture, it comes from people who had a hard time of it. And rather than saying, oh, we need more people in poverty so we can have more great rock and roll, I think the question is, if those people had had some support and it had, you know, the sort of basics of life, how much greater might that culture have been? And New Orleans is a real study of that. And I won't go into its whole musical history, but there are a bunch of musicians who made an enormous impact on America who often, you know, ended up dying in poverty and, you know, couldn't make a go of it at all.
Daniel Wolfe, our guest this hour, his book is The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. He went down to New Orleans 5 months after Hurricane Katrina hit, and he has been going back to New Orleans time after time after time since then. The book is a result of that, and he's also co-producer of a film, I'm Carolyn Parker, which will premiere on September 20th on PBS. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thank you very much, Tim, for your call. And actually, it's not Tim, but Tim's wife. And I forgot your name, but thank you very much for that interesting call. We'll take more calls in a moment. 414-227-2050 is our number today. 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Oh, I did the... Oh, okay. Well, we'll go back to phone calls then. And let's go to Ron in Manitowoc. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, hi there. This is really rolled. I go by Ron so that people don't know who's really calling. There aren't too many people with that first name of mine. Just wanted to call to indicate when Dan talks about going back to indicate that our National Church Youth Gathering, the past two gatherings in 2009 and just one just concluded down in New Orleans, have had over 35,000 high school youth and adult chaperones down. into New Orleans, and the decision to go to New Orleans has been a very intentional decision so that the youth might go down, be exposed both to the culture of New Orleans, but also part of the entire program involved all of the youth and adults going out to provide service in the different areas, especially into what Dan has been calling the green dots, those areas. Prior to Katrina, I had been down with a group of youth again at our National Youth Gathering, and our work took us out into the Desire area at the end of the streetcar line. And the youth, in terms of their service down there, cleaning up, assisting in reconstruction, et cetera, and private dwellings, that kind of thing, have just had an outstanding experience down there. Yesterday I talked to one of the young ladies who simply indicated she had had an outstanding time and planned to go back when she was able to do that. So our church has gone down there. Our local church has gone down several times to help in the Gulf Coast area. But this time specifically into New Orleans with over 35,000 youth and adult chaperones to do whatever they could do.
Daniel.
That's remarkable and great, and it's extraordinary to me and to the people we talk to how many churches of all denominations were basically first responders to this. They came down, they helped people gut their houses, they then didn't just go home, they kept coming back, and coming back, as you indicated. Yeah, I kind of have two reactions to that, and besides just thankfulness. The one is that wouldn't it be great if we could set up a city and a society where churches didn't have to do this? It's wonderful that they do, but it worries me a little that we're depending on people's response in a charitable way, when ideally you'd set up a system where the equivalent of FEMA or something like that or something within the city responded. The second thing is, and this was true, we found with volunteers, church volunteers, and people who came down for something like Common Ground as well, that I think it makes a tremendous difference when the kids and the adults go back to their homes, in that it isn't just New Orleans that needs help. It's probably someplace right near where they live as well. And I think New Orleans, in that way, it was an unfortunate disaster, but it was also an incredibly educating moment for basically a generation who have taken a different view of how they can help, what their government can and can't do, and the possibilities of, as I say, making a new city.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. Cecilia writes on our email, is there a movement to restore the wetlands as a preventative in future devastation?
Yeah, absolutely there is. I mean, Common Ground did it on a small scale and is still doing it. But there's also a lot of the money, you know, what happened to poor southern Louisiana is they no sooner got their heads above water, so to speak, than the BP oil spill happened. And that ruined a lot of the wetlands. The plus side is I think people saw that it was vital that they come back, and there's been a bunch of money that's come in because of it, both from the government and from British Petroleum, that I hope will go to rebuilding the marshes and stopping their destruction, which has to happen soon or they'll be gone.
Thanks very much for the calls, everybody. Just a side note here, when did you write that Sam Cooke book?
Oh, Kathleen, that's not fair to ask me. Many years ago. I think it came out probably in the late 80s.
Oh, did it? Can we get... Yeah. I'd love to interview you on that.
I would love to.
You
talk
would
about
do it? Okay.
I would love to do it. He was and he is a great man.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll get the book, and we'll talk to you about it a couple months down the road. Well, thank you, Daniel, and people should keep their eyes out for the September 20th premiere of I'm Carolyn Parker.
Absolutely, and I hope they read the book however they manage to get hold of a copy.
Why, is it hard to get a hold of a copy?
No, I just don't mean they have to buy it. They can go to their library and read it.
Oh, Daniel, that's generous of you. Or you can buy it, too. Daniel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Daniel Wolfe, the book is The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. Tomorrow, These guys are really fabulous reporters, and I just wanted to draw attention to Don Bartlett and James Steele have written a new book. We hear so much about outsourcing and companies that have gone to China and what's happened to communities in this country as a result of NAFTA trade policies that have come into place in the last 10 years or so. The stories aren't pretty, and they are documented in Don and James' new book, The Betrayal of the American Dream, and they are going to be our guests tomorrow. They do superb work. They have for years and years. They've won two Pulitzer Prizes for newspaper reporting, and they will be with us to talk about The Betrayal of the American Dream tomorrow. That's one of our hours tomorrow. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this hour, and I also wanted to thank Katie Madsen for her help on our programs this morning. That's it for now. Great conversations ahead. Thank you for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.